sharing the piece of paper. So we've divided these questions up. Not everybody in the panel will get all the questions, but we will get to each of you in turn. So, and we have like 7-ish minutes for each of you. So, my first question goes to Mike and Trent. How have you built trust and this working relationship?
How we built trust in our relationship. How has our relationship grown to what it has been? Maybe I can take that one. You know, we've definitely kind of walked before we ran. You know, we figured out some of it, but I think this is really cool, and I think this is really important, but, like, we sit around the table, and we put the problem, and we solve it, and working together and being transparent together is helpful. I think that builds some trust in the relationship. We definitely know we're working with Mother Nature when it comes down to growing, so some things might start later than others, maybe some of that is just being conscious more than a trust. We know it all works itself out. We definitely spend a lot of time talking, you know, and I think talking is a big piece, and that's where I make that comment about the table, and we do like to eat, like, make no mistake. If you go for breakfast, Mike will make really good bacon. I don't know where the pork comes from, but we really do sit around and we just kind of problem solve it. You know, the distribution, I think, you know, in partnerships in general and in purchasing is what most of my day job is. A lot of it is just being transparent and being fair. Maybe I'll give you guys an example from us, at least in some of that discussion. But if the legs on the stool are uneven, then the relationship's not going to be, you know, fair. So I think a lot of it is being transparent. We started out our first year, we were, I think, 17 shares. Then we went to, like, 30 or 40, or did we really turn it up that next year?
No, I think it was 30, 40-ish.
Yeah.
And then we went.
And that's, I think that second year into the third year, it became a discussion of, like, what do you guys need? This is that discussion piece, you know, what do you need? And then we'll figure out how to make it work. So we asked about, because capacity became one of the issues where we were at in that second year. Land is limited, obviously. And you guys would have had to make they needed a commitment from us to make a commitment to take on the land. I think we really just said, what is it going to yield? You said 100, and we said, cool.
Yep.
And just pretty much went to figure it out at that point. Being in food service, we're definitely a business of saying yes. We're not in the no business. So what that really means is you're just problem solving. And collaborating and communicating, I think that's gone a long way. And over those time, it's helped really build the trust. But some of it is just blind trust maybe going into. I don't know if that really answers that trusting piece or your question as it was written. But, I mean, overall, we don't question anything. We definitely are not remotely as rigid on numbers as we probably should be. Thankfully to the farm, because they deal with our challenges with cash flow, essentially, paying bills certain times or, you know, hitting it. Because we space out our payment. We don't pay it all the traditional CSA model. I mean, that definitely puts a lot of trust from them on us. I don't know, maybe you want to shed some light on that.
Trent said the main piece for us, we'll sit around the table couple times a year. Trent will come out with a couple chefs, and we'll see what's working, what's not. We discuss things that weren't seen in the previous year, and it really is just problem solving and listening to each other's needs and being willing to do a little change here or there to make it work for all of us. Knowing which lettuce to grow for the commissary over what we're normally growing. The financial portion of it, I guess Jody and I are trusting people, and we feel it's going to happen. You know, we trust Mother Nature to give us a fair shake every year, and Tahir's willing to work with us when it rains, when it's not supposed to, when we're in the middle of harvesting green beans or something along those lines.
So. Well, thank you. Next question is for Sarah and Annalie. Is there an example of a problem that has occurred, and how do you work to resolve issues?
Here we go. Absolutely. Anytime you try something new, there's problems that arise. When I first started aggregating in Wabasha, I did it illegally for 2 years. So I sat down with the Department of Agriculture and later with the Department of Health and said, hey, here's what I'm doing. How can we do this legally? In Minnesota. In Minnesota, you need a license to aggregate. In Wisconsin, you don't. In Minnesota, you can have certain products. In Wisconsin, it's the rules are absolutely different. And so crossing the border with the products became complicated. And what you could and couldn't cross the border with, including the market share boxes. As the market manager, I was bringing produce from the Wabasha farmers back to my home to aggregate. And so we had to make sure that we were following the law. So that was complicated. And meeting with buyers often heard requirements like GAP audits and requiring, you know, FSMA compliance. So in Minnesota, we now are mandating that each of our farmers attend a food safety training. We're hosting those trainings. We just got done with one today. Thank you, Annalisa. We are asking our farmers to write up an on-farm food safety plan and do water testing. That may or may not be a barrier. We've seen that being a barrier or a challenge in Wisconsin. I think that one of the things we thought we wanted for our community was to ask our farmers to provide an insurance, naming us, how did they want it, not additionally insured. Yeah. And I know that that held our farmers back and made them fearful of the project.
Yeah, so I think just a step back for Lake Pepin Local, as we were deciding to do this online sales platform, it became clear that we obviously needed to worry about liability as a group because we were then operating as a group. And so in our case, we actually then ended up forming a group LLC as Lake Pepin Local in order to legally do this and be able to get liability insurance as a group. So that was something that we did not really foresee and became a big roadblock at the beginning of the season last year. So then that led us to, and I think that question kind of came out of trying to figure out the legalities around selling which products through the online sales platform. That's sort of how all that came to light. And yeah, that became a big bridge to cross.
Especially working with a group, that was really hard because there's popcorn ideas. We met with an attorney who told us we are not nonprofit. We met with a CPA who said, you're nonprofit. What you're doing is totally a nonprofit. And so we actually worked through this with Farm Commons and found their business entity guide really, really helpful. And they helped us narrow down, like, how do we draw this out? And so we are now officially today, actually, a legal group LLC.
Thank you.
Yeah, I know it's hard not to keep wanting to hear from everybody at this point, but we're going to be, keep, write down your questions, or we'll give you some papers if you didn't get the answer. So right now we're going to talk about determining prices, and I'm going to ask Rodrigo, would you talk about how you determine your price?
Well, that's a good question. Right now my business is focused just on wholesale, and I working with CSA, but the way how we working with CSA is just my farm focus on the four crops. So another farms they focus on a different crops. How decide the prices? I selling to co-op partners, to the wedge, to share ground, and Kowalski sometimes when we have extras. For us, they have the prices already. So we need to deal with the prices a little bit about sometimes every year. But I think to on fall is when the prices increase a little bit. So the relationship with this wholesaler is like, I think every year they increase a little bit. Sometimes they drop with this with things overproduction, they drop a little bit. But I'm gonna talk about broccoli because it's our main crop, and it's just a little bit on the beginning when everybody has broccoli. On summer time it's harder, so nobody has a lot of broccoli. On fall is the price drop a little bit more, but just on the end of fall the price go really 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 up. So what I can say is the relationship. So every year they try to increase the price. I working with different prices with different companies. So the wedge pay different than co-op partners. Kowalski they pay a little higher. And share ground, because we own share ground, so we try to get more. So I don't know.
Thank you.
How we deal with the prices.
Yeah. And I was going to ask from the perspective of a distributor, Jack, if you would talk about how do you negotiate prices with farmers?
I guess I view our group as a kind of a, not officially a cooperative, but I kind of view it as a vertically integrated cooperative from the consumer's perspective all the way back to the field. So for me, I want to think about what's a sustainable living wage for the farms involved, and how do I afford then to pay for the warehouse and the distribution and the kind of other logistical costs, and therefore what do we have to charge the consumer in order to make all those things work all the way back. So it was interesting to hear, well, the price of broccoli is higher here and lower there, and I mean, like, that's kind of what, thank you. With the broccoli fluctuating in price, I think about we're planning ahead maybe 18 months of what our production's going to be and figuring out those prices. So, for example, I emailed that I felt like we needed to change our chicken pricing for various problems that I don't need to go into detail. But I emailed all three of the farms that are raising the chickens. I think everybody was CC'd on the email. Yep. So it wasn't like I emailed Keith and I didn't email. Everybody got the same email and could reply to all and said, here's what I think we need to do. I think if we go with this pricing instead of last year, this would work better as a whole. And what do people think about it? So everybody could chip in, like Keith can say that works for me, someone else that doesn't work for them. And then as a group we can decide, you know, what that pricing needs to be. I did a similar with beef. But some of the beef farmers we work with don't really like email, so little inconvenient. But I called all of them and just said, we're paying, you know, 50 cents over Thousand Hills. If I go to Whole Foods, a chuck roast costs this. This is not financially viable forever for everybody, right? So now that we've worked through these challenges, what can we do? What is financially sustainable for your farm at the size that you're at? And everybody's in a different place in their growth. So some of the more established farms, they were like, well, this price, you know, this works for me. And the other ones, you know, maybe were 10% higher that they needed. And so trying to navigate what works for everybody, and it's cool. They can say, my bottom price is, you know, $2.85 or whatever. And then I say, well, we're not going to go that low. And as a group, I can come up with the same price so everybody can get paid the same for the same type of product and not be trying, you know, pitting everybody against everybody else.
When I first started my relationship with Jack, he said, what price do you need to be sustainable? So I figured out my cost of production, what I needed for investments into the barn and that, and then I gave him that price, and that's where we started. So he that's one way we built trust in the beginning, is he wanted to know what I needed to make money. And now since I'm a little more established, when we have to do some price negotiations, I'm a little more flexible to come down a little bit to help his margins to make the business growth a little easier. So it's been a very good partnership that way and a nice way to look at it.
Yeah, we have a few more minutes if anyone else on the panel wants to weigh in on the question of determining price.
Well, I mean, it's interesting how you guys, this is what I need. Let's be transparent, you know, and making sure all parties are essentially feeling good about it and it's sustainable. You know, so you're on the distribution side. You guys produce. We use it. And, you know, if you use a three-legged stool analogy, you know, I made that comment about the legs being even. If any one of those legs is not even, then you don't have a sustainable piece. And I think it is cool that you're just like, what do you need? And that's a good way to approach it. And then you can do the math and, you know, go from there.
Can you guys hear us in the back?
Yeah.
Can you hear me in the back?
Right. I do have one more question, and this might... So this one, I'm asking Rodrigo again. do you have a written contract or not? And you know, why does that even...
Yeah.
You can stand.
I'm driving a lot, so I don't really like to be sitting all the time. No, we don't. Most of the time, we sign just contracts with the Chairground. But with other companies, not just the relationship and shaking hands. I have a meeting with Rick from Co-op Partners, and we talking about the pricing at Moses. And he asked me, how was the last year? And I said, it was really bad. So, no, we don't sign any contract. I have an history about the contracts. A few years ago, I was growing bell peppers for Chipotle. It's a chain Mexican restaurant to sell burritos and tacos and salads. And I started working on 2007 with them, and I can say about pricing, they start working with us because they want to do a promotion, so they start paying really, really high. For the first year, they paying, I think, $30 a case of bell peppers, 20 pounders, and then the second year, they drop the price, $25, and every year, they lower the price really, 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 really bad. In one point, I have a meeting with them, and they told me, I'm gonna pay you $9 per case. So when I do the analysis on my cost, I lose money because it's $2 just for the case.
Yeah.
So I have a meeting with them, and the guys there, they told me, but we're going to buy you 6,000 cases of bell peppers. And if you can see, you have the chance to lose 6,000 times.
Yeah, exactly. Like, oh, big buck, thank you.
So when I say that, because I bring my notebook with the cost of how much cost for you to grow, to get a pound of peppers, and they look at me like, wow. Yes, but they say they have the price from California. And I explain them,
yeah.
I explain them, yeah, but right here, this is not California, this is Minnesota. So then I drop the contract with them. And I see, at the beginning, sounds really, really nice, because they tend to do a promotion so they can sell more. But then for a small farmer, they need to be very careful when they sign these contracts with these big companies. You need to see the cost, you need to see for how long it's going to be, and then you can decide. Yep.
So we do have a few more minutes if anybody else wants to weigh in on the question of contracts.
I can, so shared ground, we've definitely tried to do contracts with, it used to be that we kind of just did contracts with the owner farms. And then we realized as we grew, we were asking partner farms to grow significant amount of produce where they needed contracts as well, so that they felt comfortable putting all that into the ground. I don't really know the professional side of this business very well. We're have kind of figured this out as we've moved along. But as far as I've been able to tell, besides maybe the Minneapolis public schools, there's no such thing as a contract in this business. We've had people talk really lovely to us in the winter about what we can sell to them, and if they're not selling it, it comes August, and they might say they want whatever 200 cases of broccoli a week, but if they're not actually selling it, then they're not going to buy it the next week. And so it's all relationships. And so what we try to do is, and it's been nice having 4 or 5 years of experience, because we have a lot of data and we can kind of say, okay, this is what I think we can sell. But what the general conversation I try to have is, this is what I think we can sell, if this is what you want to sell. And then it just becomes, during the season, a lot of conversation. So a good example of a bad time was, we had a big contract. We used to sell a lot of cherry tomatoes, and we had 3 years of selling cherry tomatoes, and we lost our tomato grower, and we had another person we bought from for a while, and they wanted to grow into that market, and so we built a contract with them. They produced, they weren't as high a quality as we were used to, but they were fine. They were nice. The grower was doing their job well. But we lost that market, and I think it just had to do with the timing of when the tomatoes came on. They weren't quite as nice as the markets were expecting, and we just saw it plummet to where we just weren't selling any of their tomatoes. And then it just became a conversation of, okay, how many do you actually have? What else do you have that we could sell or buy to kind of make up for some of that money? And I think it was hard for the grower. But I think that actually helped us. By the end of the season, we had sold what we, say we wanted to sell $30,000 of their product in contracts. We sold about that amount for them. It just didn't happen to be in tomatoes as much. And so it was just an open process. And the other thing that was really nice, and that I really appreciate about the co-op, is in general, when there's a problem, we just have open books. And I can go back to them and say, look, I know we're not selling your tomatoes. I'm sorry. We are not, absolutely not buying somebody else's tomatoes in your place, and we can show them our QuickBooks and if they want to see that. And so that's been helpful. But to me, the contracts are nice, I think, just to get everybody on the same page and as a reference point, but it's really hard to, I think it's just relationship.
Yeah.
Hold on a second. I want to make sure we have 2 minutes. So yeah, go ahead.
One thing to add with contracts, just be prepared if you're looking to get some bank financing for anything or expansion or an operating loan. They are going to want a contract to back up your niche market. So just be transparent with your distributor or your buyer that you may need a contract just for that purpose. So something to keep in mind.
Because yeah, they won't want the loan.
Right. I had to go through that with Jack because the only time we've had a contract when I needed it to do a barn expansion, they wanted a contract to back up my market. Even though I had sales history, they still wanted a forward contract.
Did they say nobody would pay you that much money for your pigs?
That's what they told me. I had sales history, but they said, nope, I had sales history, but yep, they told me nobody would do that. So
just
I found a different bank after that, and they were awesome.
Thank you. Our next questions are kind of about looking forward. And this question is for Jack and Aaron both, if both of you want to take a shot at this. Is your partnership scalable or replicable? And could you work with a member of other could you work with a number of other farmers in the way that you work with this farmer?
Can you repeat the question?
Yes. Is your partnership scalable or replicable? And could you work with a number of other farmers in the way that you work with these farmers?
Yeah, I mean, I think that some of the scalability is growing with the farm. So like Keith mentioned, his farm's grown as we've grown. It's a constant. I was listening to the produce challenges and thinking, well, we have a lot of problems handling cold storage and meat and lack of processing and our issues. But at least when our stuff is frozen, it isn't like gone the next week.
Yeah.
Like that creates a whole set of different problems with scaling, right? Because, you know, if we don't sell that chicken that he raised, like, I can, maybe it lasts a little bit longer, or sometimes we just run out of chicken, and that's okay too. It'll be 2 months later. So we can scale in a way that produce farms would have a challenge with. So I feel so. We have about a dozen farms. I think each farm in our group can grow or not grow that year. And that's okay. Some of them are really small, and that works for them to stay that size, more of a hobby. And some of them are more like Keith, where it's a lot more than a hobby. So I don't know. I feel like we can scale. There's definitely infrastructure things that are missing in the system to support, from a meat perspective, to support that. And I think even from a distribution logistics for any of these types of products that are missing, that we really struggle with to scale. I think we could probably get about 3 times our current size with the logistical system we have in place, but we would be pushing those limits. So hopefully in the next year or two, we'll be able to fix that before we run into that limit.
Could you say a little bit about, whether this model is replicable in, say, rural Minnesota? Because we've had those conversations.
Got it.
Like, not you doing it, but maybe another business owner.
Yeah, in our particular case, we're selling a premium product. Keith's chicken breast that he raises, they're $16 a pound. So it's difficult to sell into a lower density area because you've got to have the people who want that particular tasty chicken. It's different. And if you just have less people, there's just not the density to support that. Now, I don't know if that doesn't mean our business model is not replicatable, but there's a lot of infrastructure, even in Minneapolis, with all of the systems and warehouses and courier services I can hire, I'm really pushing the limits of cold storage that's available at our scale. Maybe if I was 20 times the size we are, people would want my business more, but there just isn't the infrastructure, even in Minneapolis, to support that. And if you were out in Montevideo, there isn't a public cold storage warehouse, in the county, probably. So how do you cobble together, frozen storage and be legal, which most people don't do. And so not being legal is a hindrance to scaling. It turns out. You'd be surprised what happens at scale. But so the lack of infrastructure, even in a significant market like Minneapolis, is a real challenge for meat processing and storage and distribution, which is something I kind of really want to work on in the next couple years. So we'll see about that.
Yeah, I think it's a deep challenge for us, at least. You know, so we, like I said, we hit almost 400,000 in sales this year. Our strategic plan shows us that our business plan shows that we have to get to 1.5 million in sales to be sort of sustainable economically. I think that's just the magic number that when everybody hits the 1.5 million, then they say it's 5 million that needs to be sustainable. So I don't have any real faith in that in a lot of ways. But I can say that we need to scale to be sustainable, or we need to get more grant money or something. Right now we have about, we've generally had about $75,000 in USDA grants each year to help kind of pay staff. This year we actually have about $150,000, so that's great. That's always a game. We've had a year where we've had no money from grants, and that was a squeaker to get by that year. But in terms of scaling, I think the big challenges that we face, markets are always a challenge, but I can say like this last year we actually had about $95,000 in contracts from big markets that we didn't fill, and that was just a product. We just couldn't get the product at the time that we needed the product. And that's always complicated with any markets, but definitely when you're talking about 50, 60 different types of vegetables, like we have a contract for grape tomatoes, and we may have $10,000 worth of carrots sitting here that we can't sell, but we don't have, you know, 5,000 pounds of tomatoes. And so the markets are there to some degree, more than the product for us in a lot of ways. And the other thing that's really hindering the scaling, I think, is the markets that pay really well are small, so it takes a lot more communication to sell the same amount instead of going to one big place. And we're working with small growers, and so they're not at a scale, most of them, where, you know, if I was only going to one grower to fill the 150 cases of broccoli that I need for a week, that's one phone call and one relationship, whereas with small growers, that can be 3 to 5 phone calls to get that same, get that same amount of product. And so that just keeps compounding on itself as you grow. It was a lot easier. My job was much easier working with 7 growers. Now I'm working with 37 growers, and that's 37 conversations at least, if not twice that every week. And sometimes, as anyone who's worked with us knows, sometimes it's 5 conversations in the same day as they're harvesting. And so it's a real complicated thing. I think from a farmer perspective, the advice I'd give is find out what you grow well and make sure you have a consistent supply of it and that you have a lot of it. You know, like I get a lot of phone calls from growers that say, I've got 15 cases of this week. Great. And they're overwhelmed with all this product they have. And then we work really hard to sell it. And by the time we get someone to sell it or buy it, they don't have it anymore because that succession ran out. And that happens over and over again. And that is a killer for our markets, definitely.
Thank you. We're going to do one last question before we break for dinner. And this one is for all of you. So, Brian, I'm going to have you start on that end.
And I'm just handing out pieces of paper for you to put notes, questions down. When you get out for dinner, you can stick them on that wall over there, and then we're going to organize them. And I have pens to be in.
All right, so the question for all of you to be thinking about, both farmers and buyers, what do you see as the largest barrier to doing more of these types of partnerships? Whether you're thinking of yourself doing more of those or out in the greater world, you know, what do you think is the biggest barrier?
Mike, go ahead. I'm going to say finding
finding a company that's willing to take the risk and get the reward in different, you know, different locations. I think this is what we're doing is can be done in multiple markets. It's finding the company that has the vision to do it, I guess is the short answer.
Maybe ties right with that is maybe to simplify into one word might just be awareness, to be perfectly honest. Like, I'm sitting here like, you guys do stuff, I'm like, why aren't we working together? You know, so some of it is, I think, awareness. How did we meet? It was coincidence or a couple of, you know, it just kind of worked out. But there's no doubt there is some really, really cool stuff going on that people are doing that they just, we just don't know. So some of that might just be talking more, getting in front of people that you wouldn't traditionally think to get in front of. Maybe go direct to the school or somewhere, you know. But I think, I just, maybe awareness, to be perfectly honest. I don't think people know all of this stuff's out there and then how to do it if they do know about it. I don't think the how's that really that hard as much as, so I'll say awareness.
One barrier I see is, you know, on the livestock side of it, and it went down to making sure the market is supplied. It's just, it's a large investment, and it's a long-term commitment. On the livestock side, Jack said I need 18 months of planning. I mean, by the time the sow's bred, the time that animal is finished. Yep. And I need to make sure that if the market is expecting that animal, that I have to have it there when they want it. So it takes, just, it's a large investment and long-term commitment, and that's a big barrier because it's a large risk on the farmer side of it.
Yeah, I guess for us, like I said earlier, it's really from a meat perspective side, I think it's an infrastructure issue. I mean, anybody else who, and it probably as well for produce, but like anybody else who wanted to do what I was doing would just be crazy. I mean, I don't even know where, if you weren't already doing it, and if someone literally said, I want to start your meat aggregating business, I don't even know how they could physically do that. I don't think they could get warehouse space anywhere. Like, I wouldn't know what to tell them to do. So to me, I think it's an infrastructure issue, and it's a, and there's a lack of public processing capacity as well. So even getting a courier to do what we do and drop off the deliveries for us, it was there was only like two options when we started doing it, and very limited. And now there's a couple options beyond that, but there just isn't an infrastructure, a public available infrastructure for cold storage handling of any sort. So you have to do it all yourself.
For us, the biggest issue probably has been just getting farmers in our area to buy into what we're trying. You know, it's a new market model, and they're, you know, we're beginning farmers, my husband and I, and so, like I said, we're looking for new markets. But a lot of the farmers in our area already have established markets, so they are not really interested in, you know, taking the extra time to list what they have available on the platform. And so that has just been something that we're, you know, we're just trying to get more farmers to buy in, because the value of the online sales platform is in the aggregation and being able to buy from multiple farmers at one time. So if you only have a couple farmers or a few farmers selling at any given time, it's just not, like, the value is not really there for the buyers to do go that route.
In all 10 communities that we're working at across Minnesota and in Wisconsin, our biggest challenge is demand. The demand is far greater than the supply that we're working with right now, and we need more farmers to participate in the project. And so for us, by far, demand. And getting farmers onto that sales platform, by far, demand. You're next. You got this.
What I'm thinking is two things, trust and consistency. Because it's very hard to, it's what Aaron says. Sometimes when we, one farmer approaches to, I can see this thing to, in the side of the buyers, because when I started working with co-op partners was just, it was really lucky. That time I was working with Chris Blanchard and with Linda Howley. They give me the opportunity to grow broccoli. And I have a really small amount, like 20 cases a week, just for start selling to co-op partners. And in one point, we have a really bad season. And we are lucky too, because we have a perfect broccoli in Australia Lake. And I remember the day when I delivery, I talked to Rick, and I showed to him, okay, I working with Linda, and he see my broccoli, like, do you have more of this broccoli? And broccoli opened the opportunity to sell a lot of, the other crops. So I see this thing happen when you're going to see buyers, they don't trust you, even if you say, I have my organic certification, I have my GAP certification with me, they looking at you, I don't know. And I think is, I'm going to talk about the immigrant side, because I feel that. Sometimes people on the wholesale market know me. My farm is really well known for growing broccoli. And I think it's the only way to get the trust, but it's very hard. Have the consistency every week. Sometimes people don't understand. We need to plant every week to have broccoli for 20 weeks, and have the ability to do that, have the money to do that, have the skills, and the passion for try to have perfect broccoli every week during the season is tough. It's really challenging. So when people say, okay, I want to follow your paths and I wanna be the next broccoli grower, take a lot of skill. So I think it's what I see when I see that.
Well, I think there's a lot of barriers, but challenges. But I think something that I've seen at the co-op over the years, kind of like what you were saying, is getting. And I understand that I farmed for a while, and like I understand the complexity and difficulty of this. But really, finding farmers that are willing to scale to a size where they're actually bringing in consistent quantity of. I mean, at minimum 20 cases a week, but more like 50 to 150 cases a week or something, is really how we could scale. And I think, unfortunately, there are a lot of growers, or there are some growers in our network that are at that level, and I can really tell a difference working with them in terms of simplicity of the conversation, the simplicity of the systems to get it into our market's hands. What's incredibly difficult, but a big part of what our mission is working with the smaller growers that really just don't have that same consistency yet or that same scale. And I know in the last couple of years, we've unfortunately lost a couple of really great growers that were at that scale, and I think they found that it wasn't working for them financially to be at that scale. And so I don't know how you answer that exactly, but I don't think we can scale unless we have farmers that are willing to scale to at least that 20 to 30 acre range, I would imagine, depending on the crop.
Well, thank you, everyone. Yay, we did it.
We have a few. Okay, so I was going to say, we've been about 15 minutes behind, and
we're not eating
it. Yeah, you don't have to eat it. So I feel like we could ask this last question, right, and it actually might be good because Ben Anderson is here, who is working on local food policy, and I think he might want to hear the answer to that.
Okay.
And I promise we will end at 8, so we'll make up that 15 minutes at the end. Okay, and of course at 8, if people need to leave, they can, but people will probably stick around too. So, and we will not cut out of the dinner so that you have time to talk more in small groups at that time. So let's take 5 minutes to ask the panel your question.
All right.
And then we're going to have Ben talk about what he's doing before
okay.
we eat.
So you don't really have to answer this question, but if you have ideas, I think many of us are curious about, is there anything policy, state or nationally, that you think a change somewhere in policy would help what we're trying to do? So whoever has something to offer, feel free.
I don't really have that an answer. I have that question. I was going to write it on a piece of paper and put it on the back. I'm really curious what policies are big points for you guys right now. Bueller?
I love the farm to school policy, the farm to school bill that is currently being addressed. I'm excited about it. And we need more support for that. I think that if everybody can sign on, it's all over Facebook, sign on with your organization. That's a really big step to help local farmers get their produce or their products into schools across Minnesota. And it's something that we need. They've been working on this for a long time, so I think that's really important.
I heard maybe reciprocity with Wisconsin.
Yes.
I mean, like, we have a lot of, I get a call at least half a dozen times a year from Wisconsin Co-op or deli or something that wants our products, and we process mostly out of Minnesota equal to, although I keep trying to get them to change. But there's no reason that Minnesota equal to couldn't be allowed in Wisconsin, and Wisconsin equal to allowed in Minnesota. So that would be a simple one to just make it easier.
I was just going to say, definitely one of the things for the co-op, and I think for a lot of dairy farmers in Minnesota as well, like driver's license for all, getting the ability for Latinos and other undocumented folks to not have the fear about getting in their cars to go to work every day or to deliver for farms or whatnot. I know that sounds like it might get reintroduced this session.
It's gone through committee in the House.
Yeah.
So they're looking for a champion in the Senate.
Yeah. So that, I think the one of the things we found is the, you know, I probably badmouthed our USDA grants too much because they're super helpful to us. They're hard to navigate all the time. But, you know, those Farm Bill grants are vital. They're absolutely vital, and I've never done enough to actually make sure those get passed, but I really am thankful for LSP's work on pushing for a lot of that, because that's been absolutely vital for our business. And then I think, lastly, like the good food purchasing program, really trying to get, I know that's a headache in a lot of ways, but, you know, there's Minneapolis schools have been a massive supporter and super helpful, especially early on with a lot of our work, because a lot of the city employees have a program through the city, Minneapolis City, the Parks Program in Minneapolis, but also the Public Service Center has programs for their employees to get our CSAs at a very discounted rate. And that jumped our CSA sales immensely through that. And I think the more we can get governments and cities to be thinking about that, and it seems like the good food purchasing program is one of the best ways to kind of move that forward, I think is really, really helpful.
Sarah, I see you.
Yeah. I'm going to wear my farmer hat on this one. And I'm going to talk alphabet soup. But I think that those organizations that support farmers, like the University of Minnesota, the U of M, and the food safety team, the vegetable support team that they have. MISA, the Minnesota Institute of Sustainable Agriculture, those programs are getting cut. We don't have enough people within those organizations. They keep cutting them down. The MDA, getting that support for the agriculture for when there's incidences that occur on the farm and they need somebody to work with. There's just doesn't seem to be enough staff. And finally, LFAC, the Local Food Advisory Committee, just providing that support to farmers that are coming up with innovative solutions to problems that we are all dealing with. The Local Food Advisory Committee works to find out how they can make those things happen. And I'd love to see more support for those institutions that are working on our behalf as farmers. So we need more of them.
Okay, so I'm going to invite, you want to invite Ben up?
Come on up, Ben.
Okay, Ben Anderson from our policy and organizing program is here to talk about what Sarah George introduced and beyond.
She started talking about it, so it's great. Are you going to pass out that packet for me? Great. So my name is Ben Anderson. Thanks everyone for speaking. I'm going to make a little just announcement and pitch here to do some action. So I work in our policy and organizing program around kind of transforming policy to work for kind of the vision of the food system we want, and have started, I worked on the Farm Bill for a number of years and have now started a new local foods initiative, which is really about taking the energy that all of you in this room are doing of creating kind of this amazing.
I'm sorry.
You
have so much energy, it's awesome.
So the Local Foods Initiative is a program in the policy program, which is to take all the great energy that all of you in this room are already doing in building the food system we want, and how do we change our policies to support that. And so we did a number of listening sessions in November and December. Our plan is to do a lot more, and what we're learning is there's lots of policies that need to change and lots of things that need to happen, and so we hope to be tackling lots of those. But the very first campaign we've jumped on board of is a farm-to-school campaign that Sarah talked about. So this is a bill that a whole group of stakeholders were already fighting for and have done a lot of great work on, but Land Stewardship Project has joined in on that effort to move that forward. So the handout I gave you is a little description of the bill, but the whole point of it is to, and our real goal in joining it is how do we win more institutional investment through our public institutions to really build the local food economy, and that schools is a very good first step in that, and then it's also very politically palatable to lots of people to get behind. And so we're fighting for that. The bill is moving through the state legislature right now. We're in the middle of a legislative session from January until May, and it has lots and lots of support because everybody loves the idea. But no one wants to put any money towards it. And it is running into that wall in the state legislature that all the ag money is already claimed by the current system, and we don't want to spend any more on new things like this. So we need a lot of help and a lot of energy to push this over. So included in your packet describing the bill is an action that I would love to invite all of you to take. So we need to win over all of our legislative leaders to this idea, but one who we need some help with is the governor. So the governor has voiced support for this as a former teacher, but did not include it in his budget, didn't include really much progressive ag money in his budget. And so we are asking folks to give a call to him, to remind him of his support for this previously, and to ask him to push for this legislative session. So I ask you to, you could make that call tonight or tomorrow and leave him a message or give him a talk to one of his aides, that would be great. Thank you.
I'd like to invite everyone to take part in the food that's offered out there, and we can